Blog Talk Radio.
What up? Good morning, family. How are you? Welcome to, what is this, the third Saturday in September, I believe. It is September the 11th, and we'll go into that in a minute or two. I was hoping that Thomas Berry was going to be on immediately, but he'll jump on in a second so I can jump into a quick little segment with him. Rodney's going to be on as well. Obviously, we have the Queen sitting with us this morning. Good morning, Sister Rashi. How are you?
I'm doing a lot better than you sound. And why you sound like you've been put away wet?
Sister, let me tell you something. This working overnight stuff is a bear. You feel me? And then my clerk has been out. She has some personal stuff going on, so she's been out. So I've been doing her job, my job. It's rough. And then I had a plot and plan to go to Canada for my birthday because I had never been to Montreal. Well, the plot and plan was to fly into Boston, drive over from Boston to Montreal because my personal goal is seeing all 50 states. I had never been to Vermont. And I had never been to New Hampshire. Well, I accomplished that yesterday. I got myself together, finally got up to Boston. It was a hell of a line to get the rental cars. So everything was late and kept getting later. So lo and behold, I got to Montreal around 2 o'clock in the morning this morning. Got myself settled in and all that jazz and took a little nap and showered and boom, here we are. So, yes, as we
live,
speak,
live
I
from
am,
Montreal, huh?
They I say am sitting in Montreal, Canada.
They said it's absolutely like Paris, maybe the old Paris, and then Montreal, that it's just built and designed aesthetically for people to just fall in love and be real active. I heard some good things about that. But that Montreal is where you find the American Canadians, you know. that that but yeah, because when you go everywhere else, maybe Ontario you get a couple of Americanized Canadians, but mostly because they live in such rustic conditions that they usually don't become so I guess what's the word? Citified? I don't know.
Okay.
But that you can find, the if you're going to go, they say go to Montreal because they hate us the least.
Okay.
Everybody else, you know, Alberta, and if, as you go into the, what I call real Canada, up when you start going up, you know, past Nova Scotia, up, that's where anti-American sentiment resides. Because they just can't stand us. But rest of it is so citified, it's so urbanized that they understand what we're doing down here, and they don't have as much contempt for our way of life. But the further up you go, you get more naturalists, more people who live off the land and want the land to stay that way, where it can be lived off of. And that is not how we work down here. We like to produce off the land, but we don't necessarily want to live off the land. Beautiful country. They actually, they're conservationists, so they keep in a place right. It should be green. It should be lots of green. You seeing lots of green?
I ain't seen shit yet because it was dark as hell when I drove. So the goal is to get out today. I actually scheduled myself to get a haircut, which I tend to do every now and again when I travel. You know, instead of cutting my hair before I go or whatever, I go to the local barbershop in order to get cut up. So I'm going to do that today. And I haven't decided what I'm going to do yet. It's been a long time since I've not shaved my head. I don't know if I'm going to shave it again or if I'm going to fade it. It's been a minute, so I'm on the fence right now, but I'll make a decision.
You're asking a lot out of them Canadian barbers, ain't you?
Well, no. You know, we everywhere, so I'm going to put my hands in the cat that had the most appointments because, you know, that means that he's the best barber in the shop. He gonna cut me up right, and we'll go from there. You know, I don't know. We'll see. I'm feeling a little adventurous, so we'll find out what it comes out with. I'll take some pictures and post it. Yeah, especially if I fade it, I'll take some pictures and post it. I'll go from there. If I don't, then I'll just let it be. But I'm curious to try to figure out what I'm going to do. So last weekend, while at the Capitol Jazz Fest, we celebrated my man Al's retirement, and you know, them dudes, they some drinking dudes, so they were like, "Yo, let's do a shot, son." And you know, everyone was like, "Oh, yo, you got, we gotta get some water for you to leave." And I was like, "Yo, I think I'm gonna take a shot with you, all right, for real." I said, "Yeah, you know, look, it's Al's retirement, dog. Like, I won't take a full shot, but I'll take a little something." So we did Fireball for the shot and whatnot. And I was like, okay, that's cool. Well, one of the main staples in the crew wasn't there when we did it, so he came to be late. He's like, "Well, yeah, we need to do a shot." It's like, "We already did a shot." "Oh, we need to do another one." So we did another shot, and that was a Grey Goose that go around. And
Grey Goose?
Grey Goose.
Hey, man, what are you, 11? And you done found some shots behind a liquor store, somebody... What? That's why you sounding like you've been rolled hard and put away.
No. Honestly, it's just
first of
getting
all,
in as late as I got in.
No, I'm just going to go out there on a limb. If you're out here drinking Fireball, just go to AA because Fireball is like, I want candy, but I want to get drunk. How do I mix these two? Like, it's so
how do
so
I come
blunt.
To a happy medium?
I remember those fire sticks from Jolly Rancher that I used to eat as a child. Now, how do I get that feeling and get drunk? Like, it's such a disgusting alcohol, second only to, like, honey, what is that trash I drink? Honey Jack Daniels.
Hold on, isn't trash that you drink?
It's some trash that I had drank before, and I drink. You know, like you got set up. Let's do shots. They say.
Okay.
And you do a shot out of they drink, out of what they drink, and it turns out to be like Robitussin or something.
Okay.
And it's so gross. And that Fireball and that Honey Jack, or I think it's called a Honey. I think it's Honey Jack Daniels. It's so trash. Mm. Anyway, so if you're going to fall off the wagon, Lee, you have to be brand loyal.
Nah.
Water focused.
I'm just dipping. I'm not falling fully. I'm just having a little fun. That's all, man. I decided to let loose a little bit and just enjoy. You know, which is one of the main reasons that we discussed, Rodney and I were discussing this the other day, the concept of the show today. You know, it's one of those things where, as for him, we were discussing the fact that he said on the show a number of times he'd never expected to live beyond 34. I remember my 18th birthday. I was in tech school. So in the Air Force, you go from basic military training, which is your total indoctrination, to tech school more often than not. Every now and again, you get in a career that doesn't require you to go to school. You just go directly to where you're going to be stationed, and you learn your job as you go. That's called OJT, on-the-job training. Well, I had tech school for my job. So 1992, September the 9th, I was sitting in San Antonio, Texas, Lackland Air Force Base in the day room. The day room is a common area where everyone gathers. There's a television there. There's a VCR there. Couches, chairs, so on and so forth. Sit in the day room, and I'm like, no, I'm 18 at this. You know, surrounded by people I didn't know. I'm surrounded by a setting that was cold. You know, being in the military is very uniform. It's cold. There's no warmth there. And I'm like, fuck. I'm really doing this shit, you know. So the next big birthday for me was my 21st birthday. And for my 21st birthday, I had, by that time, gone to Europe. I had seen Paris. I had seen Frankfurt, Germany. I had seen London. I had seen Amsterdam. I had seen some other stuff, you know. And I came back to the quote-unquote world, because that's what we refer to United States of America, especially at that time. And a lot of that is because, you know, when you were overseas at that juncture, you know, again, this was before, you know, video internet protocol and all that type shit, you were totally disconnected from almost everything and everything, you know. So life went on, music went on, pop culture went on, and wherever you left America at, you came back expecting the same stuff or accustomed to that, and everything had changed without you. So, you know, it's like you were in another world. That's why we call it the world, you know. So I came back to the world, and I'm like, man, these cats are celebrating being 21. And, you know, a lot of them ain't done that yet. You know, I'm celebrating being 21, and I didn't get a nice little slice of this planet. You know, so honestly, the night before I turned 21, so September the 8th, club, just partying it up. My man had come in from, what was he at? I think he was in, was he in Colorado? No, he was in D.C. He had come in from D.C. to see his then fiance, who was in Georgia. So he was leaving, like, September. He left on my birthday. Yeah, he left on my birthday. So I went, and he was leaving out of Birmingham. So I went down to Georgia, scooped him up, brought him back with me. We went to the club that night, partied it up, tore it down, so on and so forth. Had some other shenanigans go on and whatnot. Long story short, I didn't get back to pick him up until freaking 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. I think his flight left at like 10. So, you know, got him, got in the car, sat in the passenger seat. I went to sleep. He drove up to the airport and got in. And you know, this is pre-September 11th. Got in the airport, walked to the gate and stuff. We sit next to one another. I fell asleep. I'm sleeping the whole time. He waiting on the plane. Once the plane came and he was boarding, he tapped me. I got up, went back outside, got in my car, and drove back to Montgomery, Alabama. Got back in the room and went to sleep. Woke up, and the rest of my day was spent in my room. And one of those reasons is it's a lot of cats that I know that didn't make it to see 18. They didn't make it to see 21. They didn't make it to see their 16th birthday. Maybe that's their 15th birthday. You know, and the older I got, the more and more death surrounded me. I don't want to say followed me, but I do want to say it surrounded me. Because, you know, the more cats that I knew, the more cats that I became aware of who had passed away. Now, all of them weren't through nefarious reasons. All of them were not in these streets, running these streets. I mean, some of them were just fluke or freak accidents, you know. I know a cat who passed away driving a dirt bike, and he just had a dirt bike accident. And look, this cat was mean on a dirt bike. Like, this was his thing. He was on and off a dirt bike all the damn time.
You know, I teach this.
Well, no.
In the classroom, I teach this, and it becomes a very somber, silent. I teach it from third grade all the way up to, all the way up. I tell them, I show them their universal human rights. I talk to them about the fact that the shoes, the outfit, the clothes are not your most valuable possession. I make sure they understand that that life force, I put in there at least something to counter the hip-hop music, you know. I make sure they know that that life force is, in fact, heaven on earth. It, the ability to move and shape your own consciousness, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big ticket item. It's not anything you will acquire while you're doing that. It's not, none of that. If you say, I want to go to sleep, and you can lay down, and you want to eat, and you can eat, your ability to manifest, you know, not to sound, you know, like a patriot, but your ability to manifest your own destiny is your superpower. It's your actual living, breathing superpower. And I try to explain that to the young kids because it's a lot that goes into desensitizing us to that death loss that you say that was around you so pervasively. And, yes, it's still there. Depending on how you roll, right? Now, I would like to say that it follows every young boy the same, but it just doesn't. And there are factors. If your family is impoverished, if you are one of those families making less than $20,000, and it seemed like you say $20,000, that's a lot of damn money, but not in a year's time. In a year's time, what needs to happen for your existence is in America is about $35,000 to $40,000 worth of existence, and that's just eating every day, clothing yourself. And staying and keeping yourself under shelter. We ain't talking balling or traveling or nothing. America is just about a $40,000 a year experience to survive. Don't have that. The more people around you who are suffering with you like that, it increases your chances, right? Also,
right.
We don't talk about it a lot, but young boys don't eat very well. It's a lot of Hot Pockets, Doritos, and it's a lot of weird eating happening in the young boy, in young people, period, but definitely young boys, especially when they have to feed for themselves. If they're not eating something grandma cooked or something an older sister had made, they're eating very clandestinely, and it's a lot of processed foods. And that has its effect on brain function later on, Lee, and the ability to make, wise choices as to who to be with and where to be with that person. You hear me, Lee?
Totally get you, but I want you to pause for a second because Thomas is on. And good morning, Brother Barry. What's the word?
Man, you know, the word is happy birthday to you as well as Brother Rodney whenever he hops on as well. Appreciate you, brothers. I think this is a great topic, a discussion. We're currently funding the place after George Floyd died. We've had an array of killings with people under the ages of 15 and under. We just had a 12-year-old murdered by another 12-year-old after a fight at their middle school the first week of school, and the older brother of one of the 12-year-olds gave his brother a gun and told him to kill the other boy. And so with that being said, you are blessed to make it around the earth one more time, and I'm pretty sure you'll be here for plenty much more. It's a blessing. I tell people all the time,
well, God,
you know,
willing, the creek don't rise.
There we go. And, you know, I share this story that I was shot twice, you know, when I was 18, and then I got shot again when I was 19. And I was just hoping to make it to 21. And so I think that a lot of people don't really understand, and this is why I say even in Black America, it's still different levels to being Black in America. To be a Black male in America, whether you served in the military or you served on the streets, I don't think people understand the older you get, how much more as Black men we actually appreciate life a lot more when you look back and say, man, I can't believe I made it out of there. So salute to you, brothers, man, because I know y'all fought in the military and stuff like that, so I know how it is, man. So salute.
Man, look, you just don't fully get it, and I'm glad that you touched on that 100 because you're right, bro. I mean, you look back on some stuff, and, you know, I've never been shot, but I came real close on more than one occasion. I literally have been shot at, and this is before my military service. You know, this was just living and be more careful, Maryland. You know what I'm saying? As we call it, Maryland, Baltimore, Murderland. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm out here in these streets being a young man and not being so wise with some of my choices of friends nor activities. And, them bullets started flying, Jack. And I remember the first time I got shot at, and I promise you, I heard that bullet go by my ear, and I was like, holy shit, you know. And notice I keep saying that was the first time I got shot at. That wasn't the last time. That was the first time. And I was like, man, what in the hell are you doing? So I was amazed and blessed.
I got a 14-year-old.
Hold on, Rashi. I was amazed and blessed by the time I got to the house to not feel any holes, to not see any blood or anything like that. And I was like, whew. And I ain't even going to lie, son. The next day, I hid in the house. I was like, yo, that shit was bananas. But
right,
that wasn't the last time I got shot at. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, it was bananas. I acknowledged it was bananas. But that wasn't the first time that I put myself in a situation to fucking get shot at. What the hell was wrong with me? You know what I'm saying? Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, Rashi. What was your question, Rashi? I'm sorry.
That was it. That was my question. How do you all find yourselves? Is it affiliation? I'm with him. he's into something. I'm the one who's mixing and matching in these streets, you know, robbing Peter and paying Paul. How do you find yourselves, if you, especially if you don't have a gun, meaning you're not ready, you're not even ready for where you are, how do you find yourself with bullets whizzing, a teenage boy with bullets whizzing by your ear? You didn't walk to McDonald's and they just shot up McDonald's. You hear me? You left your house and you said, I'm going over. You said you had a choice, too. I'm going over this boring-ass bro house. He ain't going to play nothing but Mario all day. Or I'm going to go hit the block with these dudes. Well, talk to me. Because it's not, the bullets are not very, very seldom are these bullets being shot into your home. You have to get out of your house and go and engage into some behavior that puts you in this danger. Not to say it's your fault. Please hear me. I'm not saying it's your fault. I'm saying, but you're an active member in this situation.
Oh, no, it was my fault.
It was definitely my fault. I ain't going to lie on that bullshit. And you're right. But for me, and I'll start it off, and then I want to welcome Rodney to the show because he's with us now.
So I'll pass it off to Rodney, and then we'll come back to you, Thomas. For me, I was actually minding my own business, fell into a little bit of peer pressure, and that was the first go-around. The second go-around, I was trying to get some money. And, you know, when you're trying to get some money and somebody else trying to get some money the same way, sometimes shit like that happens. So there it is. There it was. Rodney, good morning. What's happening, family?
Good morning, brother. You know, I have to take, as we talk about this topic, I just have to take a moment to recognize something that the nation is talking about, and that's the, you know, the 20-year anniversary of the attack on this country. Because I, for whatever reason, this morning, I woke up the same time that I woke up when it happened. So I just thought, wow, what a coincidence. So I did want to take a moment to recognize the anniversary of September 11th. Lee, I was listening to you talking, and Rossi asked, I thought, one of the best questions ever, and that's how do you, I think she's phrased, how do you find yourself? And I took that to mean, how do you get out of it? Sister Rossi, straighten me out if I'm bent on this.
Not quite bent, but there, what I'm trying to explain is we're talking about this ever real idea that the life expectancy of the black man does have a serious 21-year soft cap and a very hard 60-something-plus year, you know, cap. Towards the end, we were getting very few long-lived black men. And we were discussing at this instance the first cap, that thing that black boys do in the street, that somehow their behavior manifests in their lives being shortened, or the quality of life of it being challenged. Something happens between birth and I'm going to go 25. I'm going to say the technological age pushed us to 25, and I'll put my evidence to that later. You all have a 21 cap. I say 25. But something between 0 and 25 happens with young black men where they find themselves with bullets whizzing past their ears. They find themselves, you know, in all these very precarious situations. And I just wanted to talk about the reasoning and the logic that gets y'all there. Now, Lee said peer pressure and the quest for money. And so I'm listening.
Okay, so so a part of it is societal, and that societal part is based off of racism. That's the real reality of it. It's and that is the root of it, societal and racism, because there's a structure that was erected that kind of guided many of us down the path that we led. Now, it didn't mean that we had to, you know, take that particular route, but, you know, there was some bumpers on the side that kept kind of guiding us to that point. But for me, the direct line was I was a gang member. And the first time I had to deal with that situation, I don't even know if I was a teenager yet, and I was already in a gang. And, you know, one of the things that's different for me is I'm a little bit older than Lee, and for me, it was 33.
Yes, he is, too.
Yeah, so just to go to show how things changed. So when I was a young lad, we weren't expected to live past 33. Now I'm here, and Lee is down, you know, his gen was down to 25, which is that's not a positive trend. But to be quite honest, I was in a gang and I was in a gang through my teenage years. And
I don't want to get too far. I need to ask you before we get too far. Why is a preteen boy already gang affiliated? Why are you out looking for friendship with you knew they were a gang? It's not like you thought you joined the Boy Scouts. Am I correct?
Actually, no, not really, because remember, I'm a child of the 60s. The whole gang thing was different in the 60s than what it devolved into later on. A lot of gangs started out as clubs. Some of them even started out as a group of youngsters protecting their community. And so the gang that I eventually devolved into was a group of skaters, believe it or not, who had banded together to go skate.
Roller skate.
Yeah, roller skate. And so a lot of gangs did not start out as gangs as we know them today. They started out as something else. Like I said, either they started out as just a group of folks hanging together like we did, or they start out as, some did start out as a protection crew, not even really a gang. It was a protection crew for their community. And that's how we started out. Kind of mainly it was roller skating fellas hanging together because we were a group of people that became a threat to other people. And then a couple of our fellas got beat up. And as a matter of fact, our youngest, because there were people that were part of it that were younger than me, and kind of what transitioned us, pushed us over the edge, was we had a bodega that was kind of like our place. And everybody knew it was our place. And we went there, and one of our guys was attacked by this gang called the Hellcats. They were actual gang, street gang. And they beat him up. And, you know, word got back to me that this had happened. And I've always been very protective, especially of people smaller, because I just didn't understand why would a big person pick on a smaller person. And I went looking for the people who beat up my friend. And I found them. And they took some lefts and rights. Well, of course, that didn't go well with their crew, because they were an actual gang. We were just skaters that hung together. And they came looking for us. And when they found us, we were getting ready to duke it out. This is kind of our transformation from skaters to gang. And they got the worst end of it. And then they went and got one of their crazy friends. He was also one of their gang members, very well known. And back then, it was cowardly to have a gun. Matter of fact, it was kind of cowardly to have a knife. But we had transitioned that we would have knives, but nobody carried heat. If you carried heat, you were a coward, because that meant you couldn't throw with your left and right. And that was kind of like the manly thing to do on the streets. And when his nickname was Cowboy, everybody had nicknames, and because he was kind of wild and crazy. And when Cowboy came looking, he was carrying heat. And when we seen it, you know, we took off running. That was one of the fastest runs I ever had in my life, to be honest. And, you know, when you're scared, that adrenaline pumping, you can do some interesting things. We ran around two corners, but I wasn't sure we could outrun them. So me and another member of my crew, we slid up under a truck because we ran so fast we got out of eyesight of them, and we slid up underneath a truck. Some of the other fellows kept going. Cowboy and the Hellcats, they kept chasing the other guys, but they were really after me. And I got up, me and my homie, and then we ran the other way around a different block, and that's how we got away. That was actually my first encounter with a gun. There was no bullets whizzing by me because he never really had a line of sight because, you know, I had turned backwards, got that aerodynamic fly, and
you got low.
Oh, brother, did I? I mean, you're talking about a blue streak. There was Deuces before Deuces was created. And but that was my first, as a preteen, and that was not my last encounter. There were some other encounters that were much more severe than that. But that was my first encounter with a gun. Now, when you start talking about knuckling up, we were knuckling up on a continuing basis. As a matter of fact, when I was rolling down this chain around my waist, a bullwhip in one hand, I had at some point, as things devolved, I had a knife in every pocket, and I also carried
armed to hurt someone who looked like you, though.
Oh yes, oh
you were
for
not.
Sure. There was no doubt
any of that on your true aggressor. All of that was to hurt someone in the exact same situation you were in.
That is correct.
But hold on.
That's why I say
let me break it for a second there. Well, it ain't nothing for cats to hurt other cats. It's the dogs they have trouble with. And that's a quote from the Fugees. But it's the truth. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, folks talk about this black-on-black crime mess. Everybody hurts people that they are around. So kill that noise. You know, it's just a natural order of things. Jews hurt Jews if Jews live together. Asians hurt Asians if Asians live together. Hispanics hurt Hispanics if Hispanics live together. You don't go out of your neighborhood to commit the crimes that you commit. 9 times out of 10, you stay right where the hell you live. You know what I'm saying? And commit those crimes. So because you are familiar with the surroundings. You know the people. You know when someone looks funny or they seem edgy or agitated. And, you know, that's a telltale sign to you. They may be snitching or, you know, they may be trying to harm you. You don't go somewhere where you don't know the lay of the land. You don't know how people act. Now, that gets you caught, shot, or even worse. So, no. But that's what people do. I'm sorry, Rodney. Go ahead. Continue the point.
No, I mean, to Rossi's point, looking back at it, right? Because remember, I was a child. I wasn't even a teenager. Looking back at it, we were fighting for territory that none of us were paying taxes on. If you understand what I'm saying, that street, that sidewalk, that block, and then eventually the neighborhood, and at some point. If you stay in a gang long enough and your gang survives and it grows, you will leave your community because it is, you know, like territory. You know, territory, there's a certain thing of, you know, people call it street cred. That's not what it was called back then. But, you know, you had your reputation. There
like
were
battle
little...
stars, like you can do battle, street battle. Like you said, Thomas. Thomas made a very good analogy. He said he did the war on the streets. There's the battle on the streets, and there's the battle abroad, like you all fought.
Oh, for sure. It's very much like that. It is territory. The difference is, like I said, it's usually territory you're not paying taxes on. You know, you all of that stuff, again, looking back in 2020 hindsight, right? But looking back, we did a lot of stuff that was counterproductive to us becoming positive citizens for our people. And had I not gotten out of that life, you know, I told Lee when I turned when I broke that barrier, I jumped out of the vehicle where I was and I ran around in circles three times because I lived past that point that I was expected to live. And I've said ever since then that every day that I live past that point is an extra day for me, which makes every day special because I got to live past a point that most of the people I grew up with didn't. I'm one of two people that made it out of my hood. When I say made it out, I never went to jail. I didn't get strung out. I didn't get maimed, and I didn't get killed. I actually made it out, and heck, I just celebrated my 60th of rotation around the sun, and most of the people that I knew never had a chance to even come close to half of that. And then finally, to put a cap on it, you said how? I said a part of it is situational, you know, societal from racism. But, you know, a more direct point is my mother was a single parent. And before they even came up with the term latchkey, I was a latchkey child. Unfortunately, I had too much time on my hands. You know what your grandmother used to tell you? Idle hands is the devil's workshop. I had a bunch of time on my hands, unsupervised, and a bunch of unsupervised time on a child's hand eventually will lead to mischief if there isn't something to direct and guide them away on a continuing basis. And then let me put the other piece on it. I never met my father until I turned 18. Never met him. And so there was some guidance that is truly important to all children's development, and especially a black male child's development. That, and I'm not blaming this, right, but I'm just saying that a huge contributing factor was my mother was, she worked a graveyard shift. So she and I kind of crossed paths. And I was a preteen. That's how I grew up, that early stage of my life in Brooklyn. And so having idle time, my mom not being there and not having that father, and being angry, I'll admit it, being angry for not having a father, that gives you a lot of energy, right? And you got to dissipate that energy. I tell you, even though I was very shy, I had a very short fuse. And anything that someone did that I took as a transgression that justified an act, I exercised it, hence how I got my street name. But, you know, we should not underestimate.
What was your
street
name,
Rodney? I'll tell you that later.
Okay, now, because I'm dying now. I'm ready. Please. I got to know who's the chain clad bullwhip man with all the knives regulating
knives
the streets like Rambo or something. Was you Black Rambo? Okay, I don't want to belittle this. This is important. Can I ask Thomas?
Hold on, Rashi. I want him to finish his point, and I want him to address the fact that it wasn't his dad that was the issue. That's important for him to say.
No, it's when. So let me just picture this, right? You're in, this is the 60s, and we celebrated every holiday, and you did the little construction cards and stuff for if it was Father's Day. You know, when you came back after the Christmas break, people talked about gifts that they had and what their father gave them. right? When you came back from summer break, you talked about the vacation that you went on or whatever you and your father did every September, because school in New York started in September. Every September, I got to listen to children talking about the great time that they had with their father. Because at that time, in the 60s, the majority of black men actually were still in the home, but not mine. And the term bastard was used quite a bit. And so I was a bastard, and people made sure that I knew that I was a bastard, which was a bad word for me. And seeing those children, I was jealous, but I was hurt because I didn't have those experiences. I had to be quiet. And then Christmas time, horrible for me. But the worst day was Father's Day, because Father's Day, all the children are making cards for them, and I'm making cards for an uncle or an imaginary father, or just, you know, not making a card at all. My feelings are hurt. I'm sad. I'm depressed. You know, looking back, I was depressed. And untreated depression, you know, you will act out on it. And so that was an illness that was untreated. So it was untreated, and I acted accordingly. So that what I was saying was we underestimate the role that fathers play in our children. This is male and female's lives, the influence over them. And in the mental, not just physical, because that's how we normally think of it, but the mental development of the child is, you know, you're sort of, you're injured. Your mental development is stunted, and then it's injured, and it's like it never heals right. So that's what it was like, and that's partial. That is a lot of contributing factors to the life that I led, and that made me believe that I would never truly live into adulthood.
Brother Barry, show your story, please.
Well, man, I would just say this. I could go into my story, but I would just say a couple things. I think that Rodney touched on some very good points, first off of it being systemic. And I feel like just like it's easy for us to fight each other black on black in the streets with guns and knives and even bullwhips, right, Brother Rodney? It's also easy for us as black people to snipe at each other for the choices that one another make, as if people are making these choices as if they have all of the options laid out on the table for them, right? You can either go to Harvard, you could be a successful entrepreneur, you could follow your dreams, or you could gang bang and sell drugs, right? Right?
Right.
Like those options all readily on the table for us to get all of these things, right? And mm-hmm. So I feel like we do that a lot to each other because we don't really want to face the true reality of it is that our children are not getting the same shot that, let's say, a Bill Gates and his friends got as a teenager. I can speak for myself, I don't know how you feel, Brother Lee or Rodney, or even Sister, how you feel, but just imagine if your father would have been like Bill Gates' father and invested in you as a teenager, and now you got Microsoft and one of the richest men on earth now as you're in your 60s, right? Like, that's the mm-hmm. type of investment I would say our community did not, or our people does not have in this country. I'm not talking about other people who come to this country, because that often get mixed up a lot too, right? Like where African-American men as well as women are kind of put on this pedestal as if we are the ones that's failing and everybody else somehow cracked the code. The other thing that I would say is too, is, you know, for me and the things that I did go through, I will say a large portion of it was absent of my father, but also absent of the uncles that I had that kept me in line with my father wasn't able to see. And also, I think learning about my stepfather more, understanding the ignorance that he had that he didn't really understand as a man, you know, with a woman, with his own sons, as well as raising two other boys, me and my brother, that was not his. It was a level of ignorance that he didn't understand because his father wasn't in his life. to raise him properly, right? So we got to always remember, even when a man is in the home, it may not even be the right man in the home. And even if it's the father in the home, and my mother, she says this to me to this day, you know, my mother and my stepfather still together, but my mother always says, you know, it's a difference in how Tony, who was my father, you know, it's different how Tony's, you know, boys are compared to Richard and his, you know, his boys. Me and my brother, even the one that's locked up in prison right now, we're even seen more responsible as the two that didn't have our father in the household with us most of our life. We're seen more responsible than the two that did have their father around. So it's not always, you know, you got to make sure you have the right person around and you got to have the right expectations. I believe that wholeheartedly. I feel like broken people just can't raise, they just can't raise whole people. And when I say broken, I don't mean that you don't have some type of traumatic experience, because we all go through trauma. And I believe that people use that as a crutch and an excuse. But what I mean by broken, I mean that when you really don't see yourself as the image of God, when you really don't see yourself as one of God's children, when you really don't see yourself as a person who can manifest your dreams, as Rashi was talking about when I first hopped on, then you tend to crush the dreams, you tend to crush the hopes of the young people coming up under you, and then there's the streets waiting on them. So whatever you will not provide for your babies, understand that the streets will give the allure of providing that, even if it's for a short period of time. So I say that to parents all the time, and I'm really like fighting this struggle right now with these younger mothers, as well as some of the ones of our peers, and saying like, listen, put a time out on your second childhood. Let your children be children. Because you can do the vacations, you can do the you can do all these other things, you can do the street life, you can be a socialite. But let me tell you, your children are watching. And your children, what you don't deliver, the streets will give your children. If you don't think it's going to be the streets, it's going to be some abusive woman that's going to play games to manipulate your son's heart and mind. If you don't think it's not going, if you ain't going to give it, it's going to be some drug dealer, some pimp, some gangster that's either going to beat, sex traffic your daughter, or they're going to mentally and emotionally crush her. So these are the things that I feel like, you know, growing up amongst my peers and the things that I saw. And, you know, the only thing that I feel like I got lucky with is getting out with my life, a clean record, as well as being able to have the mindset to say, all right, you've been through all these things. You've been shot. You know, you shot at folks. You sold them. You know, did all of these things. However, you're still standing, and you're still standing for a reason. I never had to be in a position where I had to snitch on a person. I never been in a position where I even had to be in anything that could compromise my integrity outside of the streets and still be able to hold on to the lessons that I got from my grandmother, my mother, aunts, uncles, as well as my father, right? So I was lucky enough to be in that position, and that's only through the grace of God, you know what I'm saying, that I'm still here at 44 to be able to tell these stories and looking at some of these young people who don't have that. So all those things that we complain about as young people, the Sunday schools, the vacation Bible schools, going to scouts or doing all the extracurricular activities that our parents had us in because they didn't want us in the street, those are the things eventually that saved my life, because I always had something to go back to when my friends didn't. I played basketball. So basketball allowed me to go back to certain things where my friends didn't have a place to retreat back to. I seen things outside of the hood. I was doing, man, hold on. I don't know who keeps on sending me these messages, but I was doing things outside of the hood for me to allow me to be able to enjoy as much as possible. And I feel like that was the lucky part. And I was able to do it in a town where I understood segregation was real. I always speak about my uncle who got killed in 1989 by his white friends, right? They drug him like James Byrd before James Byrd. So So this is in Michigan. So for me, understanding this concept and understanding what was going on, I have a different outset on life, and even like, you know, even how I view the dominant society compared to my other peers. So when I come to Minnesota and I see black folks here, they used to hand out. In Indiana, man, you got to get it how you live, right? So you got to understand everything you get, you got to earn. You got to hustle to make it, or you work to make it, right? It's one or the other. You know, that's just pretty much what it is. Somebody either got to hustle or they got a career. There's no in between. So, you know, when you got that and you can go back to those things and you can touch those bases, it allows you to stand strong. And one last point that I want to say, Rashi, how most young people really get into those things is really not being asked every day, what is your dreams? And allowing them to tell them what their dreams are and then pushing them forward. I think young black boys need to be nurtured a lot more than what they are. I've always pointed out to this thing with television, if you watch The Wire, if you watch Snowfall, if you even watch Power, you see all of these stories where these black moms are pushing their black sons into selling drugs. And that's the only way they're getting nurtured. And I would say that that's not the actual reality for most black moms, but I will tell you for most black boys, they did not get the nurturing of their mothers that they need. And I don't mean like when you're pampering them. I mean when you're pushing them to be great, when you're pushing them to be excellent, but you're also pushing them for the dreams that they want without trying to alter their dreams into what you want.
I always thank you, Brother Barry. I've been sitting here chomping at the bit, as they say, wondering, you know, what gets. And I envision it almost in a television way where a young boy is sitting there watching TV or playing video games or listening to his music in his room, and he's just bored. There is nobody to talk to. His mother is at work, and his brother, or older brother or younger brother, he's just tired of being the caretaker. He's tired of being alone with his older siblings, don't want to talk to him. And he's ready for some engagement. And I keep saying he, and I just want us to keep mindful that it's a they. It's a they. It's young girls more and more are joining these young fellows out here on the streets. And I'm not trying to divert the attention from black men at all. I just need you to understand that while we are not always the most violent, aggressive part of these unifications, we have a lot of babies with a lot of these dudes off into these cliques and clans and become affiliated in that sort with some of the violence and the benefits of the drug or nefarious money, however those gangs are raising funds for themselves. I want to tell you what I learned in my early gang training, and is that these are families. These are families of men, you know, that have made a very honorable agreement to take care of each other the best way they know how, whether it's fighting off any aggressors in a, like, almost primal sense, like the gorilla or the baboon or whatever. And then the communal money pool, that money comes to a communal pot, which is the root of what will eventually help us in the end, the ability to pool our resources and to help each other communally for a good reason this time, instead of, you know, running dope and all the other weird stuff that clicked up men get into. All I want to say is thank you, brothers. Thank you, brothers, for trusting your intuition enough to know that, bad step, and then step the other way, almost like a rat in a maze. If you know that the gold is not down there, you back up, you turn around, you go down a different path. And the ability to know that that path exists is, I think, the crux of the issue. What you said, Brother Barry, the idea of saying, yeah, Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't go to Harvard. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to put my Harvard app in. I should do that instead. No, but there is another path. It's not necessarily that, but there's always another path. Like you say, Lee, it's the military. Rodney, it's the military. Thomas, it's the, you know, whatever eventually captured your heart to know that what you were doing was wrong. I just want to thank you, brothers, because it shows the idea of another path. There is another way. And so what I need to ask you all now is this. Tell me what to tell my son when a young person shows him a huge wad of money that they have made doing whatever y'all do when y'all click up. Tell me what to do when he sees a young girl who's already affiliated, and she's, her actual job is to go out with her feminine wiles to recruit more gentlemen to come into this, you know, money-making clique. Tell me what to do to keep my son out of the bullets whizzing past his ear phase, Lee. You know what I'm saying? He's 14.
I would just say keep him involved in activities outside all of that, because to me, I feel like, here's the thing. With me, I think it was what was going on at home for me that pushed me into that direction. It wasn't necessarily what other people were doing. You know, I'm the oldest out of my mother's four children, but I'm also junior. So I'm you know, I'm not my stepfather's son. And, you know, I wouldn't even allow someone to even accidentally call that man my father, okay? And with that being said, it was conflict in the house because I was just different. And I knew it wasn't my father, and I really just didn't dig him. And it kind of, I would say a lot of it was my immaturity in a lot of aspects as a young man growing up, not knowing exactly how to deal with things, and also not actually being treated as if I was wanted to be there in a lot of ways, okay? And so once again, where you're, you know, most children who choose that, they find a lack of things happening inside of their household where they feel like they're unwarranted. The other thing, too, is their activities. You know, when I was involved in things that allowed me to see other things, I had no time to be in the hood. And while those people were constantly, they could show you money, I've always worked. I've had a job since I was 10 years old. So I've always been able to make money. And I've almost always had more money than my peers in some way or fashion. And here's the other thing, Rashi, I didn't bring up. My mother was a booster, right? My mom used to steal clothes. And so seeing my mother go to jail and seeing my uncle go to jail for drugs, I knew that cash money, you know, that fast money, there was another alternative that happens after you get caught. So there was not an amount of money anyone on the street could have showed me that would make me go that way. I think that it's just all about making sure that we're putting our children in the right perspective dreams. And one last piece is that I think we have to have a collective, realistic understanding, too, because I think that a lot of our people are dying younger because they're trying to become millionaires before they're 25. And I tell people all the time, the average millionaire in this country is 54 years old, not 25. It's only black people who feel like if you're 30 working a 9-to-5 job and you're only making, you're making, you know, middle class money, you're a failure, right? We're looking at the sanitation worker now as a failure because we don't see that person as a man that's providing for his family, right? Or that manager at Foot Locker somehow because he's managing at Foot Locker and he's 26. He's not good because he's not at the club popping bottles, right? We need to start bringing back stability and start saying, no, that guaranteed money, that stable money, as well as a saying they say in sports, that availability is the best ability to have. So people who can be available who are not going to prison, people who can be available and not in the hospital beds, people who are available and are not on the run or hiding from the police or from other people in the street, that's the best ability to have. And we've seen way too many of these situations. I'll just bring this up with my brother. The whole situation that happened with that young lady here, I always state it was because of the fiance, because of his involvement in the street is what happened to his fiance, right? And we got to tell our daughters to stay out of the way of these brothers that these knuckleheads in the streets. If my daughter ends up messing with a drug dealer, I'll be the first one to kick down the door, pistol whip him, and pull my daughter up out of there, even if I got to tie her to the chair for 90 days. I'm not going to allow my daughter to be put in that position. And I feel like that's the types of things that we as black folks, we got to start holding ourselves to a high standard for our children and letting our children know the pitfalls of the mistakes that we made.
I want to say you hit it on the head as far as I'm concerned when you said showing you something different. And I would do that with your son, you know. He has to understand that there's more to life than the block, around the corner, around the way, downtown, the capital of Missouri. He has to understand that the world is huge and vast. And he has some of that. You know, he goes to see his father. He's seen more than a lot of his friends. Keep him intrigued like that. Keep him engaged like that. Don't allow him to, as best you can, to only see himself on 4th and Newman. You know what I'm saying? He has to be able to see himself in Times Square. He has to be able to see himself in New Orleans and in Mexico or in Vegas, and you know, and if not himself specifically, then someone extremely close to him, you know. So he understands that he did it, she did it, they're doing it, I can do it too, I'm the next person up. And that will, I think, stifle a lot of his, if he has any, aggression toward or allure toward hitting the streets like that, you know what I'm saying? Because once you have in your mind that there is something else at the end of this chapter, you will look forward and work toward that something else. You won't get stuck on reading this chapter and rereading it, going through the footnotes and all that type of jazz, because you're afraid to turn the page. You will be ready and motivated to turn the page. So yeah, that's it. You know, he's 14. He should be on college tours right now. I would take him to every college tour I could possibly get him into, so that he can see that life. It might not be the life for him, but at least he can see it. You know what I'm saying? There are a lot of young people out here going to school. What grade is he in?
Ninth grade. You know, you're right. He's seen a lot, but he's also got very minimal social skills. So what my theory is there'll become some, you know, some good-looking girl.
Smooth talking.
Or something. And they'll get to talking, and next thing you know, she'll be like, I meet up with my friends at the arcade on Saturdays.
And then, nothing like a big booty and a smile.
And I'm like, you guys meet up at the, okay, sweet. You guys, okay, so here's $20 and have fun at the arcade. And then, but it's not what I think it is. You know, because these babies are afraid of a dark party in a basement as a study party. You know what I'm saying? And so you have to almost have eyes always on children. And while I'm an advocate for it, I don't know if I can sustain it as a human, creating a network of people in my life with our children's welfare, you know, at our mindset, where we agree to always have eyes on this, on our children, this particular set of children, you understand? And whether they be at Pam's house or they at the, you know, at Leroy's skate rink, we could call Leroy and say, are our babies there? Is everything fine, Leroy? Leroy say, yeah. That type of networking is what I'm afraid. I don't know enough adults to say, hey, yeah, Sarah's here with me. She's fine. Or, hey, we just don't do it no more.
Well, I think that's part of the problem, though. Part of what I've been doing is helping this pilot program to try to reduce disparities with children being removed out of the home with child protection services. So I'm taking this on the past 9 months, and I'll tell you the one thing that I've seen consistently from our people is the lack of communication and how it's hurt our families and how it's hurt our community. And I would say that, you know, the best thing to do is if you can't, you know, it used to be when I was growing up, like we knew our neighbors and, you know, everybody, if the kids went to school together, that means the parents knew each other too, so, to some, you know, form of fashion, right? They talked, especially if they lived in the neighborhood. And I feel like in today's time, where, you know, it's almost like this idea of everybody minding their business and nobody's minding the children, if you will, right? Like, you know, the children are left to kind of be on their own vices because they don't have that guidance. And with that, I would say, you know, whatever your network of friends is, you know, like, or create that network of friends so that you can have those folks who got sons that are the same age as your child, or you know, that you can have people that you can trust. Because the one struggle that my children have had moving out to Maryland with their mother is when she uprooted them, their network of their safety net was all here. They had aunts and uncles that was not blood relatives, that, you know, they had cousins that they would hang out with and, you know, do things with. So they don't have that now. So my kids have been kind of like, you know, especially during COVID, in the house. They haven't been able to socialize. And I've seen that, you know, what that did to my, you know, the effects of that with my daughter when she was here over the summer. You know, she had anxiety being around other people because she hasn't been out socializing. And so, once again, I would just say as parents, we just have to remember those things that helped us out and then try to duplicate the helpful things for our children and then try to eliminate the things that's not so helpful for our children. Because I honestly believe that if you take all of our stories, Rodney's story, my story, Lee's story, et cetera, you know, a lot of it is choices that we made, but there are a lot of things that a lot of the choices that we made were made based off of the choices, other choices that were made for us that we had no say so in, right? And so I think parents just have to make sure that we're being a little, you know, being stewards of these babies and making sure we're putting them in winning positions. And I think you can do that, Rashi. I mean, the idea of you asking and really want to see it and thinking about it, I think that's a sign. You know, I'll just go back again. You know, 2 days ago, a 12-year-old boy got shot because of a fight that happened at school. And they didn't even, he didn't even make it through the full first week of school. And, you know,
the communication between their family would not have helped. Usually what you just pushed for was family communication, right? His mama talked to that boy's mama and the school counselor or something, and they sit down. They figure out the root of the issue, and nobody has to die. But when
right.
And I'm telling you, because my cousin's the counselor, Thomas. When she
right.
calls, they won't answer the phone. When you knock on the door, they don't answer the door.
Well, I also believe, you know, Sister Rashi, it's also about expectations, too. I think that, and Brother Rodney and Lee, y'all could chime in, I think that we've lowered expectations for people. We've allowed people to use their pain as a way to tap out. I was literally on the phone with a mother on Wednesday, and I had to tell her, the social worker, as well as the person that was moderating the meeting, this is not about her. I don't give a damn about what she's been through. This is about her babies. And y'all allowed her to spend the first hour and a half talking about what she's
talking
been
about
through
her.
To not... Yeah, to not face what she hasn't been doing. And she has every excuse in the book on why she's been avoiding dealing with the issue. Does the father have problems? Yes. But you spent the first hour and a half allowing her to tell you, because of her trauma, you can't say certain words, you can't do certain things, she doesn't want to deal with men, she doesn't want to deal with this, she don't want to deal with this. And then I'm like, but your children have been in child protection services over the past 7 years. For situations with you and the father. So you both need help, and you're hurting your kids. So I don't want to hear about what you think you need, because you clearly don't know what you need, and you clearly are not handling it the right way. Let's not be selfish. And so I feel like the expectations of parents, and I said this at schools too, you know, schools have to be harder on parents. Schools have to say, we want parents who are going to partner with this community. What does that mean? You must be present. If we call because there's an issue for your school, with your scholar at school, and you're not calling, man, listen, the school should have a right to say, we called several times. We went out to visit several times. We got, unless there's an extreme case of poverty, which parents should be able to say, hey, we're down on our luck, da 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 da. School should be able to help them find services and not call child protection services. But parents still should be able to be accessible for their kids. And that should be the expectation. If you cannot be accessible for your child, then what happens if your child gets shot and killed? What happens if your child is doing the shooting and killing? What happens if somebody runs up into the school and starts shooting and killing people and we can't find you because your baby is dead? The amount of trauma that's putting on the person that has to call you. So we don't have expectations in society anymore. And I feel like even for us as young people, you know, when Rodney said, you know, hey, the expectation of life was 33 years old when he was coming up, right? Lee said 25. These kids today are like, yo, we're lucky if we make it to 20.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at that and you say, well, what we're talking about life expectancy. So that means on a cultural lens, what are we saying that we're expecting? And then we're seeing people constantly talking about legalizing marijuana.
You know, we're seeing a lot of people in our community, but I didn't even know black people did meth. But so many of our people are doing meth now, right? So many of our people are doing, like just doing the craziest thing. Sex trafficking is just crazy in our community, right? And we got all of these things because we don't have expectations. And then when we do have expectations, we're not holding people to those expectations to say, we're not going to allow you the wiggle room to neglect your children. And if you do, I always tell people, it's, you know, we talk about deadbeat dads. And I'm like, yo, it's something worse than a deadbeat dad. They're like, what? That's a parent that's there with the child that's neglecting the child. At least the deadbeat said, hey, listen, I don't want to deal with this kid, right?
Yeah.
What do you do when you have a parent that's supposed to be there that's getting social dollars for social programming to keep a roof over the head, to keep the bills on, to keep food in the belly, right? And then that same parent is not necessarily making sure that the child are having access to all of these things. You know, we got people out here that get $3,000-$4,000 in food stamps. That as soon as that card, that money get that food stamps get hit on the card, they're selling at least $2,000 of it and saying that the kids don't need the food. And we got to be honest about this as a community. You know, that's what we're facing here in the Twin Cities right now. Yeah, we talked about the police with George Floyd, but what are the self-assessments that we're doing? What is the inner reparations work that we're doing for each other? Yes, we've all been through pain. Yes, we've harmed each other, but we can't do it to our babies, and we can't allow our babies to do it to each other. So I feel like that's the mandate that we have to have. And one more piece, we can't be scared of our youth. That's the other thing, because the excuse to allow the children to do what they do, whether it's murdering, whether it's selling dope, or it's just being reckless, is because we're saying we're scared of them. No adult should be scared of these teenagers or these babies.
So basically what you're saying is I should stop buying the food stamps from the food stamp lady? Because that's...
I mean, no, bro, I'll get mine next week, but I'm buying mine next week, so I ain't tripping over that.
Don't be felonious. Don't be felonious. This is what I want to ask you all, because the information I done got is so valuable. It is, if I'm a single parent, I need to create a network of other adults where these children are never unsupervised. Riley, if I am impoverished, I need to stay alert of all the programs that are available for me in my community, and if not, try to get them in my community. Right, Rodney? If I am really worried about crime in my community making its way to my doorstep with my children, I need to what happens when you actually can't afford to live in a community that will not stop preying upon your children? Because I'm kind of there now. I can stay somewhere, but it won't be very nice. It'll just be okay. It'll be okay
now
on the inside, but it'll be sketchy on the outside. You know.
Here's something I found in that situation, because I don't know if I've ever shared this, but when I was 10, something like that, we had a house fire and lost everything. I mean, everything. Emergency situation, 911, low battery. It was crazy. We moved to an apartment complex on the far northeast side of Baltimore. And, you know, most of the things were able to be recovered and stuff like that, but we only stayed there for about a year. Let me tell you something. I moved a whole lot as a kid. You feel me? A whole lot. Too many times to really be like, that shit was cool, because it wasn't. But, you know, mom was single, had two kids at the time, and she was trying to do the best she could do what she had. And if the rent went up another $30, then that $30 wasn't in the budget. You know what I'm saying? We wanted to eat. So we may have had to move. Well, long story short, put us in a situation where I think housing called or came up or whatever, and we got the word, well, not we, she got the word that we could move to a two-bedroom, one-bath house in a community called Cherry Hill, which is the community that I claimed that I grew up in Baltimore, because in a lot of ways I did. She lived there, she, not we, because I didn't live there for long. She lived in that community longer than she lived anywhere. Throughout my life.
as a kid. And that's why I claimed that community. Well, Cherry Hill was not a welcoming place at all. It was gunfire, the OK Corral. It was bad. I mean, it was really, really bad. It was so bad where the shit didn't get mentioned in conversation. It's just like, yo, you live where? Ooh, it was like one of them. You know what I'm saying? And I remember her saying, hey, we're going to move. And I was like, in my head, I'm like, fuck, again? So I'm like, where are we moving to? And she's like, Cherry. I was like, yo, I ain't going out there. It was one of the best decisions that she could have fucking made, to be honest with you. It was rough. Yes, it was. But it was so communal. Going back to what Brother Barry just said, that place was extremely, extremely communal. People had lived there forever. It was generations upon generations of people there. So, I mean, entire families lived in the community. And it was very much we take care of one another. Now, we still do evil shit to one another because we're still, you know, crabs in a bucket. But we take care of one another. I say all the time, like, there are only two ways in and out of Cherry Hill. And there was one way took you through another community called Westport. And for whatever reason, Westport and Cherry Hill did not get along. And if you got on the bus and you were the only Cherry Hill dude on the bus and everybody else was from Westport on the bus, you were going to get your ass kicked before they got off that bus and vice versa. It just was how it went. And we could fight amongst one another in the community, but when we left the community, you would think we were the bestest of friends. We took care of one another. We stuck out for one another. If you saw a motherfucker that, you know, lived around the way and that motherfucker was in a fight, you was in the fight too. It was straight like that. So it might not be that bad, to be honest with you. It may very well be the greatest thing you could do because, yes, it may look rough and sketchy and all that shit from the outside. But once you get established and you start meeting the elders of the community, you may very well find one of the best homes that you could ever find, to be honest with you. And honestly, I take pride in being from Cherry Hill, as far as Baltimore is concerned. I take pride in being from Cherry Hill because it was. And it still is in a lot of ways. My eldest nephew, unfortunately, he lost his grandmother. And the community really showed up and showed out because his grandmother, again, was one of these generational people that lived in that community. And they showered love, support, whole nine on her children and her grandchildren. You know, she passed away like week before last. So, yeah, it's been pouring out. And my cousin lost his brother about a month or so ago. And it was a very similar situation for that. I mean, I just so happened to go out the hill on the day of his repass and whatnot. And it totally was, at least in my head, a coincidence because I didn't plan it that way. I just was like, yeah, I got some time. Let me fly through the hill. And it just so happened to be the day of his repass. So, you know, I chilled and took in some of the family. And we sat back and, you know, we reminisced on the crazy shit we used to do in our youth. And it was wild. But, yeah, it may not be as bad as it looks to be 100 with you. So if that helps any. I don't know if it does.
It does.
But if that helps.
You building a community is where my head is at. You know, one community
right.
at a time, like Mr. Rodney explained, and those communities link up and you become a neighborhood, and the neighborhood becomes a district, and the district becomes a, you know, and in that way, you can sustain the idea of safe being not that black children can't be out in the world, safe being
mm-hmm.
that people who don't have the best interest of the community have the whole community to reckon with, not an outside force like a policeman who doesn't live in that neighborhood, or, you know, mm-hmm. or even a rival community who also don't stay in that community. It is up mm-hmm. to the people mm-hmm. who inhabit the different residencies to say, hey, even if we do want dope, we don't want it like this. You're going to have to tone this down.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I mean, even if we, I mean, however we do this, you can't bring the quality of life in this community down so that we all can't live safely and our children can't play, you know, basketball in the streets without bullets whizzing past their ear.
At the end of the day, we all want the same thing. You know what I'm saying? Now, we may go about it in different ways, but we all want the same thing. We all want to feel safe in our homes and our communities. We want our children to grow up to be smarter, hopefully more rich than we are, or just better off in general than we are. We want good food. We want safety, security, and you know we want to be able to live our lives as best we can.
So, okay, so you know I'm all about application. I'm all about application. So would you say this is fair? If you are a parent of a boy, okay, of any child really, but of definitely of a male black boy, right now, go and make sure you have a number to either everybody that child is, every child that has a phone that plays with your child, or the parent of the child that plays, or the people who are around your child. If you know, if you can know, like after school, I mean, you can't know at school for real, but like any time when they're supposed to be in your care, but they're somewhere else, you should have as much detail, contact information at least for that person as you can possibly generate right now. Would you say that's applicable? That's a way of knowing that if you ain't with that child, you at least talk directly to whoever is with that child. What you think about that?
That's definitely the way. I think that's how you build community. I think that community can be built through children. It can be built through the ice cream socials. Like, listen, you know, white folks have built communities the way that they have for a reason. And we sometimes be like, okay, this is what white folks do. But if you ever notice about white people, they always build everything around family and community. Everything starts there for them, right? So that's why they have all of these fairs and festivals in these small pockets of suburbs and communities, national night out. Because they understand, you got to know your neighbors. You got to have that communication. That's how you keep things intact. That's how you keep families intact. So you should, you know, if your son or your daughter is hanging out with someone, you should know the mother and the father who they're with, as far as at least lay eyes on them, have a phone number for them, and then also be able to communicate with them so that if something is going on with their child, you may have to be the one to pick up the phone and call them and say, hey, I saw Darnell at the grocery store. He acting a fool. I tried to talk to him, and hey, he ain't listening, but I felt like I wanted to give you a call to let you know what's going on with him, right? That's a lot different than what we do now, where we just see crazy stuff. We don't communicate with the parents. We'll hop online and talk about the kids before we say something to their parents about what's going on. And I feel like that's a part of community building. We talk about the kids not knowing how to socialize, but I also feel like there's some social cues that we've kind of like generationally dropped off from our elders, where they understood that. They understood that, hey, if you play at my house, you spend the night at my house, I know your parents. You with my kid, I know your parents. If I don't know your parents, I know your grandparents. I know your aunt. I know your uncle. I'm knowing something about you for where if something happens, good or bad, I can communicate with those people who are taking care of you. And I feel like that's very important. And the other side of it, too, one more piece I want to say is we got to make sure that we start teaching our children that friendship does not just mean because somebody goes to school. Be cool with the kids in your community. I like what Lee was saying about the folks in the Hill. I feel like a lot of children these days miss that because they got friends outside of the neighborhood they live in, and they really don't even talk to the kids in their neighborhood.
Right. But I want to give you something else, Brother Derry, and everybody else. not only if you stay at my house, I know your people, but if you stay at my house, I get to whip your ass. If you get out of line, I'm whipping your ass, then I'm going to tell your mama and your daddy.
That's true.
You know
That's
what
true.
I'm saying? Look, Keisha was over here shaking her ass on TikTok. I checked the chin. I wanted to let you know, so when she get home, you get in her ass again. You know what I'm saying? Like, yo, there's nothing wrong with a parent parenting. The parent doesn't have to be the parent of the damn child. You know what I'm saying? So you want me to wait for them to stick the needle in the arm or wait for them to rob the store and then call you so you can then come over? Like, it's too late at that point. Or do you want me to nip this thing in the bud right now, tell you about it? Like, yo, you know what I'm saying? This little motherfucker over here on TikTok, I'm about to get in that ass, but I wanted to call you and let you know. If you want to come over now, cool. If you want to wait till they get home, cool. But this motherfucker is straight up, I mean, not just shaking. I'm talking popping, boom, 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 like she ground. That ain't going to work at all. I know you wouldn't allow it in your house. I ain't going to allow it in my house. You know what I mean? So, yeah, man. Like, you know. Now, I'm not talking about, like, being like this resource officer that fucked the kid up the other day. Like, you know, that kid was grown. I ain't talking about that. But, I mean, you totally out of order. Then, yeah, check that kid. Check that chin. You know what I'm saying? Absolutely.
But see, that's an agreement you talk about when you begin your network. When you all begin to talk to each other, when you form these team, you know, text teams or, you know, groups on in group chat, I'm trying to figure out the most convenient way to do it because it ain't emailing. Most people don't check their email even if they have it at work and on their phone. It's a texting situation. Hey, you know, here's pictures or here's your child or here's, a, you know, is this okay? Is this, you know, we going here? Do they have, is there something you prefer not happen? I mean, I want our children to get to know each other, but I want to make sure that the rules in my house, the rules in my house are the same, you know, as close to whatever's happening in your, and that's the problem. The standard of living per household, the quality of life, the idea of what is normal per household. And somebody would have to establish that. It's not, it's a fluid thing, I'm pretty sure, based on culture. But there are some ground rules, like, you know, something about teenage boys and my daughter being able to visit. I never. If you got a boy in your home older than you, my daughter can visit, period. It's been, you know, and it's a lot of little rules like that. If I already know that there's some kind of drug activity happening in that household, my babies can't go in. Your daughter, your child or son, you know, can come out and play with my child as much as they want to because that's how friendships are born. But my child can go inside a dwelling where I know they trafficking drugs. It just don't happen. I know the child ain't doing it, but I still can't do it.
Right, but let me say
there
this,
there should be some basic rules. Okay, so you say, I want to form a community network so that collectively our children are safe and are able to play with each other in this community. That's a thing that people say, right?
Yes.
I don't know.
I hope they say it.
Okay, all right. So in order to do such a thing, you have to lay some ground rules. Now, see, this is some new stuff because I remember being raised under don't go inside. I don't care if they got gold bars in there. They would have to bring them outside because I was not allowed to go inside of even my best friend's house. Did anybody else have that issue?
Nope.
Not at all.
No.
Not at all. That is uniquely you.
Okay. Well, a lot of children today cannot go inside.
Mm-hmm.
You can play all you want outside. You cannot go inside. Okay, for those children who can go inside, there needs to be some fundamental, you know, agreement between those, whoever's in charge of those households.
I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that at all. I don't want us to get too stuck on this because we only have like 25 minutes left. So I want to bow it up if possible. Again, going back to the beginning, the point was and still is, it is a blessing to be able to still inhale and exhale air at this age. You know, there were many a day that I did not think that I would get here, but thus far I'm glad that I have. I'm very appreciative that I have. It's been a great journey. Along it, I've picked up some awesome associates. I'm sorry, that's not true. Some good associates, some great friends, and some awesome family. And that doesn't necessarily mean that our DNA reads the same, but our alignment is the same. I was having a conversation with a sister the other day about something, and she was like, yo, I just want to find somebody that I'm equally yoked with. And I was like, She's like, why you say I said, where you at right now? She said, I'm at work. I said, you're at work. She said, yeah. I said, how does your team at work? Oh, it's great. Everybody does what they're supposed to do. How many of those people around you believe have the exact same opinions about life, money, religion, so on and so forth that you do? I never thought about it. Yeah, but you all work great together. The common goal is the common goal. You all are focused on a goal. You can make it work no matter what. That was my point to her. You know what I'm saying? So my point to you all is if you are or have lived beyond where your mind originally thought, take that as a lesson and a blessing and turn around and give it to somebody else. Show them as often as you can through words and deeds that there is more to life than what they are seeing right now in front of them. Show them that there can be a better day. That doesn't mean that the days are without struggle. That doesn't mean that the nights are without pain. But there can be a better day. You can do things a different way. You can achieve things beyond your wildest imagination in the moment, you know. And keep pushing. Honestly, just keep pushing, because it will come. It will come. If you put yourself in a position, it will come. Things will turn and get better, without a doubt. So that's what's up. Now, speaking of it, going back to what Rodney said, I wanted to go a little bit more into it, Rodney, than just a moment. It has been 20 years since the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York City. I remember vividly where I was. I was at work, actually. And where I worked at was directly in the flight path for BWI, which is Baltimore Washington International Airport. So there was nothing for us to hear planes constantly coming in, taking off, coming in, taking off. I remember being in my office, and a cat that worked with me, he comes out, he says, oh, you see that plane that's crashed into a building? I was like, what? He was like, man, a plane just crashed into a building. I was like, what building? He said, man, one of the towers in New York. I was like, for real? So I'm following him to go back to his desk because he was watching it on his computer. And that's when the second plane hit, and I was like, yo, we are under attack. He was like, huh? I said, dog, we are under attack. You know what I'm saying? He's like, man, good. It's like, next thing you know, at the bottom of the screen, it says, we're under attack. And this is a terrorist act. And that plane traffic went from the normal to deathly silent. And you just don't know how much noise those planes make until they're no longer taking off. You know, it became white noise because you were so used to hearing it. You know what I'm saying? But when they weren't taking off, it was like, holy shit. Like, those things are loud. and it was constant. So it was like, wow, like there's other sounds that I hear that I never heard before, you know? And I was in a situation where a couple of days after September 11th, I was actually scheduled to be someplace else. I don't remember where the hell it was. But I was on the bird. No, that's not true. I know exactly where I went to. I went to Nebraska. I was scheduled to be in Nebraska a couple of days later, and I flew out to Nebraska. And it was crazy. Going through security with all the checks and the extra checks and the extra checks. And I was like, what in the hell? But then TSA was formed, and we've been saddled with that ever since. And I say saddled because I noticed something that the Irish Republican Army did when I was in the UK. The Irish Republican Army was extremely successful in draining the pockets of the crown. It really was. And they would do this here and they would do that there. And the way the British government responded initially was throwing money and people at it. But one of the things they learned was that wasn't the way. It's like, if we keep doing this, we're going to be broke. So they adopted another philosophy later on with their battles with the IRA, which is let them do whatever the fuck they're going to do, and we'll just fix it, and we'll continue on. And they did. I remember the night before I left, the IRA literally mortared the fired mortar rounds at the runway at Heathrow. And they did that shit for like an hour. They just dropped mortars in. Boom, 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 boom. I don't think they destroyed any aircraft, but they really messed up the runway. Once they stopped, the British came in, fixed all the holes, repaved it. Planes were running and taking off in no time. Like it wasn't nothing. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, I've seen us not only get entangled in Afghanistan and where else were we at, Rodney?
Iraq
and Afghanistan. But also, and I'm not taking a shot at the TSA at all, but all this money that we're spending on equipment and newer equipment and so on and so forth, the terrorists never have to down another plane again. They never have to. They probably never would. Why would they? They've already done that. They've already proven that they could do it. Why would they go after another plane? That makes no sense. It makes no sense. You know what I'm saying? But we are constantly pouring money into Homeland Security with respect to aircraft attacks. Time, you know, year in and year out. Why would they do that again? It makes no sense. I know I'm repeating myself, but that's already been done. The next thing is what you need to worry about. And they win no matter what. They win if they do a next thing or not, because we're always trying to counter the potential of a next thing. And you have to really balance that out and be wise, not only in your money spending, but your people spending as well. Because you can very well get tapped out all the way around. Resources as far as people are concerned, you can burn people out. We're overworking them, not giving them enough time off, so on and so forth, to recover, recoup, and be fresh. And money, obviously, because you can very well run out of money. Paying for these people to work them to death. You know what I'm saying? Rodney, your thoughts?
Well, I did want to go back to the previous topic and recommend if Sister Rashi hasn't read it, I would ask her to read the Moynihan Report, not because there's not biases in there, because there are, but it was a predictor of the future that has come true with many of the things that were written in that report. And it's really short. And I actually have a copy of that report in my bookcase as a reminder, because we were forewarned and we did not take the necessary steps, and pretty much everything that was predicted has come true for the black community. So if you get a chance, read the Moynihan Report. And I know Brother Barry has read it because he spoke on it before. When it comes to today, Lee, as you know, I was still active duty. And at the time, I was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base, which is where I eventually retired out of. And my wartime job, it was instrumental in the fight. And I had been working 30 days straight. And September 11th was my first day off. And just like I woke up this morning at the time that the plane hit the tower, I woke up hearing the news of the first plane hitting the tower. I was bone tired, but I heard it in my subconscious, passed it on to my conscious. I got up to see for myself through my eyes, and they were saying that it was, they believed it was a Cessna. Must have been off course. Well, I was an aircraft mechanic. I know what a Cessna looks like. That wasn't a Cessna. And I could tell that it wasn't that the plane was off course. The plane, you know, angled into the tower. And immediately, now remember, I've been working 30 days, my first day off. Immediately, I got out of bed, and I was running for my uniform.
Not dressed.
I don't even know if I got my uniform on all the way before the phone rang. And I remember telling my family, we're under attack, and I'm probably going to be recalled. And sure enough, my chief, who I worked for, a colonel, but a chief was my immediate reporting official. And he called me. And normally when we get recalled, it always starts out, exercise, exercise, exercise. Is this Master Sergeant Smith? Report to, once that was confirmed, report to whatever, exercise, 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 and initiate your recall list. And a recall list is a phone number that you call the next person in line to tell them the same message, and that way you pass the message down really quick, and you have less than 45 minutes no matter where you are to report to work. Well, I knew when I saw that happen, I would be recalled because my wartime job was to coordinate all of the ground space or a huge chunk of ground space at Nellis Air Force Base. And because there was a particular thing that was going to be kicked off from NORAD that I practiced in, I knew that that's what I was going to have to do. And I can tell you what was different in the call right off the bat. I mean, I knew it was coming, but I hadn't heard it since I was in the Rapid Deployment Force since I had worked up range, is when the chief called, he didn't say exercise, exercise, exercise. He says, and he knew my voice and he knew my number. He said, so I said, hello. He says, hello, this is Chief Master Sergeant so-and-so. Nisi
wow.
Smith.
Wow. Yeah, that's real right there. He didn't say Smitty. I got you.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I knew it was coming, but it's different when you hear it, though. And then when you hear it with the seriousness and determination in the voice, and I verified who I was, and then he said, You're being directed to report to work ASAP, initiate the recall list, and report. This was the part, though. This was the kicker, I guess, of all of it. Report to the WOC. Now, the WOC is acronym WOC, and it stands for War Operations Center. When you hear things like that, it was just ominous. You practice these things, but when I had to go, you know, when the whole Iraq thing, when you hear that stuff, it just gives you a whole different sense of reality. I guess I'll put it that way. And my mission was to clear the airfield and prepare the airfield because we thought we might have been attacked from China or something, and that the war would be prosecuted from the West Coast. Mm. And so all jets were already on the way to Nellis Air Force Base because this was going to be the key staging area before jumping across the pond. And my job was to clear the airfield and bring my people in to recover all of these transient aircraft that were about to go to war. Huge. Not to mention that because of Nellis Air Force Base, we have a lot of air traffic, and we also have McCarran Airport that brings in about 40 million people a year. One of the eeriest, and you all probably experienced this where you are, one of the eeriest feelings was the silence that Lee talked about. But for me, to look up into the sky and not see a bunch of airplanes, there was one airplane. There was one airplane flying over Las Vegas, and it was actually a C-130. That was it, and it just kept flying in circles. Well, that airplane actually is a nuclear-sniffing aircraft, and so it was flying, orbiting the city, making sure that there was no nuclear activity in this area. Then to kick it off, we got word, and this really didn't, it made the news and then they pulled it, that at the same time that the aircraft was heading for Shanksville, that there was another aircraft, commercial aircraft, heading west towards the Hoover Dam. And as you all know, that provides power to like 7 states. And it would have flooded here. It would have been a major disaster. And they said, and then the last word NORAD sent was that the aircraft had dropped off of radar. We scrambled fighter jets. And when I say scramble, yes, it looked like TV. The only thing is we didn't have anybody on status, which is one of the things that was changed. We didn't have anybody on status. So the squadron commander grabbed pilots as he was walking to throw in
his... Hold on, Rodney. Slow down. Because people are confused. You said we didn't have anyone on status. What does that mean? What is being on status mean?
So in the old days, we would have aircraft standing by in case we were attacked by primarily the Russians. And they were always with a pilot in the, oftentimes it could be, depending on which alert it was, a pilot could be in the seat with one engine running and people like me ready to launch that aircraft out to intercept incoming enemy threats, whether it's aircrafts or ICBMs, to be quite honest. And so on status, Zulu alert, Victor alert, those were the different types of alerts that the Air Force had. And so we didn't have anybody like that because that mission had been downgraded years ago. I used to train that mission though. So I knew what it was like. So when the word again came from NORAD that there's this commercial aircraft heading towards the dam and it dropped off of radar, that made...
I wonder what made it drop.
Well, that made us think that usually when an aircraft purposely flies low, it is trying to evade radar. There was all aircraft had been taken out of the sky, that there was an errant aircraft up there heading towards the Hoover Dam, dropped off of radar because it was angling towards taking the dam out, which would have, you know, been a major terrorist victory and calamity for us. And so they scrambled the aircraft, the fighter jets, to go and intercept, I'll put it that way, this mystery aircraft. And that I really can't, not able to go into the other details, but that was my experience of 9/11. And my aunt worked, she used to ride by there in the train at the time that the towers were hit. And I didn't hear from my aunt, and nobody else did. And we thought that she didn't, you know, unfortunately, she may not have made it. Luckily for her, that was the day that she was late for work and wound up not leaving the house and then hearing that the towers were hit and stayed home. And so that was a blessing that may have given some extra years to her. So that was my experience of that morning and that day. Really, it was preparing us to go to war.
Yeah, I immediately thought about going back in if I could, because you know that patriotism, duty, service before self, all that kicked in. When stuff like that is beaten into you or delivered to you so much, it really does become a part of your DNA, which leads me to something that Brother Barry posted. And Brother Barry, you posted a picture of a note about, you know, using your PTO time and taking time for yourself and so on and so forth. That really resonates with me right about now, because normally I'm off on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Situation cropped up this week, and it really bleeds into that. But I don't want to get into details right now. But I felt that, and I really appreciate that. You know what I'm saying? Without a doubt, those are words that I needed to hear as well. So thank you, sir. You just never know when you post something and that will resonate with them, without a doubt. So I'm very appreciative of that note that you made.
Hey, well, I'm glad you got it, brother, because all we got is our health and our time. And sometimes I feel like the one thing that we, especially black folks, that we underestimate is that we give so much of our time away to other people that we really don't get a chance to utilize it. And we're real dedicated to our work.
Right. Yeah, for real, for real. But, you know, thank you to all of those who have served or are still serving. You know, we are forever in your debt. It takes a very special person to do what you do. A lot of us are misunderstood because we do what we do. A lot of us are misunderstood after we do what we do. You know, I was watching something the other day. I think it was one of those shows on OWN or Lifetime or something. It was like a fiance or family or some shit like that. And it was a son and mother. Both of them were veterans, and they were talking about emotions. And the mom said, you know, you're trained that showing emotion gets people killed. You know what I'm saying? And I was like, yeah, because it does, you know. But that's something that you have to untrain yourself, if you can, as best you can, once you get out, because most people don't operate like that. They don't even understand that premise, but it is what it is. Thank you all for joining us on this day as we celebrate life again. Rodney, happy belated birthday. I know I said it to you directly and stuff like that, but happy belated birthday. You know, to everyone whose birthday we may have missed, happy birthday, a belated birthday to you all. It is definitely Virgo season. Enjoy it. Family, thank you all for joining us live later. As always, we appreciate you. We'll do this thing again next week. And that's what's up, y'all. Y'all be good. Enjoy your Saturday. Be good. Be safe. We love you. And a damn thing you can do about it.